Well, for listeners tuning in to listen to another episode of Conservative Casual Friday, you've heard, hopefully, if all goes well in our programming here, Rock the Casbah from The Clash in 1982. And we want to be thinking about the Middle East and perhaps the time of the 80s, 1982, and when you had, for example, Hezbollah kidnappings of and shootings of people at universities in the Middle East, American-founded universities in the Middle East, in particular, the American University in Beirut, among others, because we have a new book out from the experienced writer, and he's been involved with the Trump campaigns, as well as working in the George W. Bush administrations, Pratik Chugale, who has a new book out here, American Universities in the Middle East and U.S. Foreign Policy, Intersections with American Interest. Show that again there. Well, Pratik, thank you for joining the show.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Well, this is a week here on Conservative Casual Friday. This is a weekly blog talk radio show where we like to discuss important issues of the day for conservatives and others. And we also here are making a video of this event, which will possibly be broadcast on other channels, local television channels. Well, first starting out, Pratik, you write in a book about universities, American-founded universities, like the American University of Beirut and the American University of Cairo. Where did these universities come from? Who founded them? When were they founded? What was the motivation behind them?
Well, I look at a number of different case studies. So two of them you mentioned, the American University of Beirut and the American University in Cairo. I also look at American universities in Afghanistan and Iraq, as well as American branch campuses in Qatar. Now, all of these universities, I pick them because they illustrate different ways that these universities tend to emerge in the Middle East, and each of them have a different founding story. But I would say that, generally speaking, this idea of importing American universities to the Middle East goes back, actually, to the 19th century, well before the U.S. government even had official relations with the Middle East. And they really originated first and foremost from American missionaries who went to the Middle East, obviously with the idea of converting the people of the region to Christianity. But then when they encountered difficulties in that respect, they figured that, well, we need another way to gain trust with the people of the region. And they thought to import American universities as a means of maybe seeing if that would help in the missionary endeavor.
Yeah, that's interesting. You detail in the book, well, with these first foundings, this entire history of American-founded universities in the Middle East or the wider Middle East, including places like Afghanistan. These original foundings, you talk about the American University of Beirut, originally founded as the Syrian Protestant College in 1866, then reorganized as American University of Beirut, AUB, after World War I. Did such missionary efforts or at the American University of Cairo, you also mentioned the Robert College founded in 1863 then Constantinople, now Istanbul in Turkey. Did they have much success in this missionizing among Muslims of converting people with this sort of maybe traditional Christian idea of you offer sort of services, charity or development, and that way you try to engage with a population to broach the faith of Christianity to them?
Well, Christian idea, which was the term you used, is a very interesting and provocative way to put it, because I think that it illustrates a lot of the dilemma that the American missionaries and then later on their secular successors ended up embarking on, which is to say that if you look at the missionaries and the universities and you ask, were they successful in imparting Christianity or in converting people to Christianity? I would say, generally speaking, they had a very poor record. But if you look at it in a broader sense, did they have success with certain ideals that were liberal in nature, maybe inspired or informed by Christianity in some way, but that are ultimately secular, universal, and so forth? I would say that the universities actually had a pretty good track record, and particularly compared to, for example, French universities, British universities, others, I would say American universities proved to be far more influential and far more likely to gain the trust and support of the people in the region.
Well, what other university foundings were there? I mean, you mentioned in the book, in the case of Lebanon, comparing and contrasting with AUB, you have this a French creation founded by Jesuits, a St. Joseph's College founded in 1875, a French language school, in contrast to say, AUB in Anglophone school. What did say, like, Britain or you know, also having English language schools, did they have much success with universities in the region, with given all of their colonial influence in French and Lebanon and Syria and the British later in Egypt and Iraq as well? What sort of success did they have?
This was a very interesting thing that I learned while writing the book, that prior to the era of American predominance in the Middle East, the French and British were major external powers in the region back when they were really in the empire building game. Now, the French and British took very different approaches to this issue of higher education and their colonial endeavor. French imperialism, and the French were a significant occupying power in Lebanon, Syria, as it was called back then. And as you mentioned, St. Joseph University really was the flagship French effort. Now, at the time that the French were occupying Lebanon, the St. Joseph University played a very important role because it basically proved to be or functioned as a feeder for the most prestigious positions in the French occupation government. But the dilemma with that was that because the university was so tied to French colonial rule, when the French ended up basically departing from Lebanon and the region more generally, St. Joseph really lost its influence in the region. Now, the British were a different story. So they were, for a certain period, a sort of de facto colonial power in Egypt and Iraq, and also the Gulf countries were British protectorates as well. But I would say that, generally speaking, the British did not really prioritize or emphasize the promotion of British higher education in the areas that they governed. And I get it a little bit into the book as to why. But so all of these factors sort of created an opening for American universities to come in, because the demand for Western higher education was not really being filled or fulfilled as much as the region's people would have liked from the French and British.
Well, you know, you talk in the book about American universities in particular, you know, having a lot of respect, being sort of the gold standard of education. I mean, sort of, you know, ranked worldwide that way. I mean, the higher education in America is often considered, leaders in the world, among the best in the world. If American schools have been so respected and desired in the Middle East, have Middle Eastern countries ever tried to replicate such universities? Or why not? I mean, why hasn't there been any sort of move to, like in Jordan, let's set up a Jordanian university and we'll use American style or something like that?
No, absolutely. And this is actually a very important trend in higher education in the Middle East, that because American universities and American higher education really is regarded as what I would say the preeminent brand in global higher education. Naturally, there are upstart universities and so forth who are trying to model themselves, not only model themselves off an American university, but very explicitly call themselves an American university. So if you go throughout the region, you'll see in different Middle Eastern countries, universities calling themselves like the American University of Kuwait, or there are many others in the region. But just because they call themselves an American university is absolutely no guarantee that they in fact embody all the standards and ideals of American universities. So in my book, I open the book by really defining what a university has to be or do to qualify as a genuine American university. And all the case studies that I looked at in the book do meet those standards. But just because you see in the region a university called the American University of X, is no guarantee whatsoever that it meets quality thresholds that we would expect.
So, for example, like the American University of Kuwait, with such schools, they would then, bring in American teachers, American faculty and such, and try to replicate, as you say, an American standard. What sort of problems, then, if you talk about the American University of Kuwait, a school which you don't particularly look at it in the book, what sort of failings are they having?
Well, I mean, I think the way to think about that question is, what is it that makes an American university different from other universities? I mean, there are, of course, very good universities all over the world that are not based on the American model. In an earlier era, one could argue that German universities, for example, were the preeminent global universities, and certainly British universities, even today, Oxford, Cambridge, and so forth, are highly respected universities. But what really makes an American university distinct and something that people want is, for example, an emphasis on the liberal arts, or tenure protections for faculty, or high standards of respect for freedom of speech and women's rights and diversity and the like, or you know, other things might be the kind of instruction and coursework that is emphasized, like on writing and papers, you know, faculty student ratios, their commitment to community and service. There are a whole bunch of these standards. And they're actually quite difficult to meet when you think about it, especially when you're starting a university in countries that don't have the same democratic meritocratic traditions as we do. So, you know, these aren't necessarily, I mean, it's not always clear, you know, whether or not a university meets the standard, but those are some of the criteria that a university would have to meet.
Mm-hmm. You talk about, you know, one of the goals as you indicate with American University of Beirut or American University of Cairo, and then moving in more into the modern times, you look at these cases of under the war on terror, starting with George W. Bush administration, you had these two foundings of American universities, one in American University of Iraq in Sulaimania, and then an American University of Afghanistan in Kabul. Have these universities really then had much success in this goal of trying to sort of liberalize, modernize these countries? How has that played out?
Well, so you mentioned the American University of Afghanistan and then Iraq. So both of these have a similar origin story, which is that after 9/11, when the U.S., in response to the 9/11 attacks, invaded Afghanistan and Iraq, these missions ended up becoming fairly large-scale involved state and nation-building efforts. And so it was in that context that the American government really took the lead, working obviously with partners in the private sector and with the governments of the region to establish American universities. And so this was quite different, of course, from the American universities in Beirut and Cairo, which had developed more from private initiative. Now, I would say, at least in one case, the American University of Afghanistan, I think one can say broadly that the effort did not succeed for the simple reason that the country now is under Taliban control and the university has been overrun. It's now, it has relocated now to Qatar, and you know, we'll see what happens there. The American University of Iraq, it's more of a success story. And I think the reason is because early on, because Iraq, for the most part, including the capital, Baghdad, was so unstable with the insurgency and the civil war, a decision was made to put the university in the Kurdish area in the north. And so right from the beginning, it's enjoyed the support and security from Peshmerga Kurdish forces. So the university has managed to figure out its security situation. And it'll take many years, obviously, to really figure out the impact. But so far, I would say it's at least figured out how to take root and graduate Iraqi students.
Okay, so for the American University in Afghanistan, they've gone to gutter now, you mentioned. Are they like just, say, refugees from Afghanistan, or anyone who can get out of Afghanistan that would go there?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, it was interesting, literally, shortly before the deadline to submit my manuscript, the university ended up getting taken over by Taliban forces who had just taken over the country. And it was quite tragic that because of the way the American withdrawal from Afghanistan happened, the speed and so forth, there were many people, Afghans and others, who were affiliated with the university who had a hard time getting out at the time that the Taliban was taking over. So I think that the fate of the university, how it manages in Qatar, remains to be seen. But, you know, in terms of the original purpose of the university to be based in Kabul and functioning really as a means of educating Afghans to build the country, build a democracy, I think it has very much fallen short because of the security situation there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's kind of makes me wonder how would such a university continue if it's going to be an Afghan university. I mean, how would, you know, Afghan students get there? Or is it just going to be, you know, like an aid program for anyone who happens to flee Afghanistan? Or I don't know, people think we'll work out some arrangement with the Taliban, that the new government, that people can actually, you know, leave Afghanistan to study abroad. Although I can't imagine the Taliban would necessarily be all that interested in having people get an American education anywhere in the world and coming back. So those are curious questions there.
Yeah, I mean, I write in the book that well before the Taliban takeover, the American University of Afghanistan had been a source of attacks. The Taliban and Haqqani Network and other Islamist groups had very explicitly and deliberately targeted the American University of Afghanistan as a representation of what the U.S. was doing in the country. But also, obviously, they have ideological qualms with the university, for example, the emphasis on women's rights and so forth. And there are a number of cases, I get into the details in the book, about how faculty and others were targets of hijackings and kidnappings and so forth by insurgents. So, you know, we'll see how the Taliban evolves and so forth. But I have not seen any reason to believe that the Taliban is going to allow the university to function in the way that it was intended.
Well, that's an issue you mentioned in the book about the sort of like backlash from groups like the Taliban that are in no way welcoming towards any idea of like women's rights or liberalization, liberal education. Well, then how is this American university in Iraq, as you discussed in the Kurdish area, a much safer area, how's that been received?
From what I can tell, well. I mean, and it's interesting because at the time that the idea was floated initially to have an American university, it was actually quite controversial among the Kurds. And the reasons are because obviously the Kurds have long had aspirations for independence and so forth. And so the question was, you know, when you have an American University of Iraq, which is premised on the idea of a unified Iraq, that it would help not just the Kurdish area, but the entirety of Iraq develop, the obvious question is, well, how does that sort of jibe with or influence Kurdish independent aspirations? From what I can tell, I mean, the university, I think, has disproportionately served Kurdish students for obvious reasons. I think that in terms of the quality of education, it's considerably better than the vast majority of offerings available to Iraqi students. And so I think like elsewhere in the region, whatever philosophical or national qualms the people of the region might have with the U.S. or with American values and so forth, the quality of American higher education just is so far superior to the vast majority of what's available that for the most part, these universities have been well received.
Well, you know, you talk about standards for an American university. You know, I, of course, the main thing, as you indicate, would be academic freedom. What sort of challenges have universities like, say, in Iraq or, well, of course, you know, now Afghanistan's got taken over, but elsewhere, you know, American University of Beirut or American University of Cairo, have they had in upholding academic freedom? I mean, what differences are there from, you know, think of an American university in the United States, and what challenges do they face there?
Well, there are considerable and major challenges. And I mean, anyone going to an American university in the Middle East who thinks that it's going to be the equivalent of going to UC Berkeley or Yale or something, I mean, it's just not going to happen. These universities, at the end of the day, rely on the acquiescence and protection of the governments in the countries where they function. And so, I mean, the governments in the region, all of which are authoritarian, can more or less shut these universities down whenever they want to. I would say, generally speaking, and I get into the details in the book, but generally speaking, the regimes, the governments in the region have recognized that these universities provide something very important in terms of the developmental needs of these countries. They're very popular with their own people. And so while I would say that these universities do not protect liberal values and academic freedom and the like to the same degree as American universities stateside, they do, for the most part, have more protections than is the case in Arab universities.
Mm-hmm. So I guess maybe like at such universities, I guess perhaps a key issue would be you'd sort of have to watch about what you say politically. I mean, you wouldn't necessarily want to have a political demonstration. One thing you brought up, as you study these, in your other case study, you study these American branches of universities, branches of American universities in Qatar, from Georgetown, Texas A&M, Cornell Medical School, or Northwestern University. You talk about, there's mention in there that religious freedom has not been respected at these universities. How does that occur? What sort of violations have taken place there?
Well, so I think it's important to explain a bit what is a branch campus. So basically, when Qatar had a massive windfall from natural gas and so forth, they basically made a decision that they want to invest in an American higher education to make that available for their people. So they had the option of creating, let's say, an American University of Qatar or something like that and build a university from scratch. But they chose not to do that for a variety of reasons. What they did instead was they identified what are the big needs that the country has, and then they looked for the best universities around the world that offered these programs. And so they went, for example, to Carnegie Mellon for engineering or Georgetown for political science. And they basically said, look, you have these American universities, they're functioning well, you guys know what you're doing, come and set up a branch in Qatar. And so then, the question obviously becomes, well, how do you set up a branch campus of an American university in a Wahhabist, Islamist, authoritarian country without any of the same protections? So there was a lot of negotiation and so forth. And basically they ended up reaching compromises in terms of what American universities would be allowed to do. And I would say, given the state of Qatari norms and so forth, it's actually quite remarkable how much freedom and rights these universities, these branch campuses do have. But it's not perfect. And if you look at the State Department reports, for example, on human rights and religious freedom and so forth, one of the things they flag in the case of Qatar, for example, is certain violations of religious freedom, freedom of speech and so forth that are occurring at these branch campuses.
Mm-hmm. Well, thinking about American universities again and looking at other schools, have any countries looked at, say, for British universities? I mean, University of Oxford or Cambridge University attempted anything along these lines in the Gulf or anywhere else with a branch there?
Yeah, so I didn't get into the details of this in my research, but my understanding is that when the Qataris were basically looking around for how to do branch campuses, first of all, it's important to note that there are many branch campuses in Qatar. Not all of them are American. So they have indeed imported universities from elsewhere. But my understanding is that the British universities were not as receptive as Americans were, generally speaking, in setting up branch campuses, which again, in a longer horizon. This has actually been a fairly consistent theme when you look at American versus British statecraft in the Middle East. I think Americans just have always been more eager to get into the higher education game. But there are some British initiatives in the region. I talk a little bit about them. But I would say American universities are far exceed British universities in popularity, number, influence, and demand ultimately.
Mm-hmm. Well, you mentioned briefly, you focus on Qatar as your case study, but you talk about UAE, United Arab Emirates, is also following a similar path, but there are various sort of distinctions that UAE is not so focused on, say, sort of elite schools. Discuss, compare and contrast that experience of the two Gulf states.
Yeah, so, Qatar and the UAE both of which are Arabian Gulf monarchies, have been two very disproportionate outsized leaders in the region in terms of trying to bring American higher education to the region, and particularly through the branch campus model. And the reasons for that, I think, have to do with, number one, just how much money they have, the kind of governments that are in power. They're both modernizing governments. And obviously, they have unique vulnerabilities and therefore an interest in cultivating ties with the U.S. government and so forth. So in that respect, they're very similar. But in terms of the strategies that they've taken on how to get American universities, American branch campuses in the country, they've been a little bit different. So Qatar has been a little bit more of a state initiative. So basically, the Qatari government has really taken the lead in identifying what are the national priorities we have, and then how do we recruit sort of a limited number of really high quality schools that can come in and try to further these needs. Whereas the UAE has taken a bit more of a market-based approach. So they've kind of set up these free enterprise zones, and universities and entrepreneurs have come and tried to set things up, and some of them have worked, some of them haven't, but it's a bit more of a laissez-faire market-based approach.
Well, looking at the Qatar example, you know, there's been significant criticism of Qatar, home of Al Jazeera network, for example, that, you know, it's really this font of this base of supporting Muslim Brotherhood influence. I mean, you had the late Sheikh Yusuf al-Qaradawi, often considered sort of like the spiritual leader of the Muslim Brotherhood, was based in Qatar, and just spout off all sorts of radical things of supporting terrorism against Israel, or saying you have a right to beat your wife or whatever, and really sort of heinous figure. Have these universities, these branches of American universities in Qatar, have they been subject to any of that influence, and are they actually then sort of magnifying any such Qatari influence around the world, in the United States in particular?
Well, this is a very interesting dilemma that Qatar and other countries find themselves in when they make a decision to bring in American universities. Because one motive, I think it's fair to say, is that when you bring in an American university into the country, you either directly or indirectly show both your own people as well as the broader world a positive face of sort, that you show that you're trying to modernize your country, liberalize the country, and so forth. And obviously, in some ways, this is a public diplomacy effort that, when Qatari diplomats and so forth go around the world, they can say, well, we're bringing in these American universities. And I talk about how at difficult times in the American-Qatari relationship, you'll see Qatari officials emphasizing, we have these American universities, kind of to show the positive side, so to speak, of Qatari influence. The challenge, though, is that it's a double-edged sword, because even though these universities may be intended to project a benign influence, once you invite an American university into your capital, and along with it Western professors and American money and the like, you also tend to invite sort of a spotlight or a flashlight on other things that are happening in the country, which may not have received the same attention. For example, one of the branch campuses in Qatar is Northwestern Journalism School. Right. So when you have kind of American trained journalists now in your country, and not surprisingly, they're going to report on things that the Qataris may otherwise have been able to sweep under the rug. And this is an ongoing challenge that Qataris and Americans at these universities are navigating on a constant basis.
Well, talking about extremist influences, one thing I found really interesting, you discussed obviously American University in Beirut, AUB in Beirut, in Lebanon, obviously a place that can be very dangerous in the past, certainly. You note that in 2017, AUB had to pay a judgment to the Department of Justice because they were found guilty of taking USAID aid and aiding Hezbollah in the form of training, offering education courses to Hezbollah members on campus. Discuss that a bit. How susceptible are such universities like AUB, or for that matter, AUC in Cairo, or even now in Iraq, or of course, while we've discussed now the American University in Afghanistan has been closed down. What sort of dangers have been there of you're actually you know, helping other people who are precisely opposed to any such liberal Western ideals.
Well, AUB is certainly an important and cautionary tale in this respect. And if you think about it, the basic dilemma that these universities have is that there's always this question, how much do you ingrain yourself or become a part of the country, the society, the politics, and so forth? And each of these universities have answered that question in a different way. The American University in Cairo tends to be a bit more, I would say, maybe elitist, a little bit more detached from Egyptian society, whereas AUB has tended to be more ingrained in Lebanese society. Now, one consequence of that is that the Lebanon, of course, has always, to some degree, really been at the heart of the Palestinian resistance, and often many of these Palestinian groups that adopt terrorist tactics and the like. And so really for many decades now, the Palestinian cause has been a major part and major factor at AUB. Hezbollah even today continues to have a very significant force and presence on AUB's campus. And so the university has actually found it quite challenging. They have a core mission of educating Lebanese students and inculcating them in American values. But at the same time, Hezbollah and other Islamist groups not only have a presence, but if you look historically, AUB often has been at the center of really organizing and galvanizing and recruiting these groups, not obviously formally as an institution, but these individuals and groups have really coalesced in the AUB community and done great damage to American interests.
Mm-hmm. So you would say then that in contrast to AUC in Cairo, there hasn't been, say, much Muslim Brotherhood influence there. So there's sort of a contrast there that AUB has been much more political. Hezbollah will really operate there to sort of recruit and gain support there.
Yeah, and I mean, part of that just reflects the politics in these societies. I mean, Hezbollah, not only at AUB, but throughout Lebanese society, including in the Lebanese government, as you know, has a pretty active role, whereas in Egypt, the country is ruled by a military dictatorship that has, for the most part, really cracked down on the Muslim Brotherhood. And so, I would say Islamist influences have not gained traction at AUC in Cairo anywhere to the same degree.
Well, and we talk here about the dangers of being at these universities. I mean, you note in the book that on the 1980s, we let in here the intro music we're playing on the audio for Rock the Casbah from 1982. You note all the Hezbollah assaults on and kidnappings at AUB. Indeed, one of the presidents of AUB in 1984, Malcolm Kerr, if I recall his name correctly, was shot at AUB on the campus right before he's going to go meet with a special envoy, Donald Rumsfeld. How much danger has there been at such campuses? I mean, we've got AUB, and of course, well, you also talk about the security concerns a bit at Afghanistan. Or how safe have these campuses been?
Well, the security situation at these universities has fluctuated, just as it has in the country writ large. The interesting thing about the Lebanon case study is that AUB consistently has defied predictions and expectations that amid a deteriorating security situation that the university would close down. And the university has managed to survive even in the midst of a very dangerous and serious civil war. Now, the question is, why is that? And one of the reasons is that warring groups in Lebanon, for all their issues and difficulties, have more or less arrived at the conclusion that the functioning of the American University in Beirut serves enough of their interests that it's not worth really derailing. So you look, for example, at Hezbollah, which one would think obviously is a very anti-American group, which it is. Hezbollah has consistently held back in terms of its attacks on AUB. And one of the reasons, for example, during the civil war in Lebanon in the 80s, all of the warring factions basically ended up utilizing, for example, the hospital services at AUB. So you know, AUB has managed to kind of navigate this very complicated, delicate balance and ingrained itself enough in Lebanese society that it has managed to stay afloat. But at the same time, just because the institution has managed to stay afloat, that doesn't mean that Americans individually who have been at these places have been safe. So as you alluded to in the 80s, Hezbollah and other groups made it a practice of trying to identify American individuals who represented, in their view, American power and the like. And they basically sort of spotted them on campus, kidnapped them, and then basically led to a whole hostage crisis. And even to the present day, American students, faculty, and the like, not only in Beirut, but elsewhere, cannot by any means take their safety for granted.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think, you know, thinking then of AUB and Hezbollah and radicalization, I found it interesting. You discussed that in the right after World War II, you're leading up to the establishment of Israel in 1948. If I recall correctly, reading in the book that both leaders from AUB and the American University in Cairo opposed the establishment of Israel when that question came up for the Truman administration. What is the relationship of these universities been then to American policy, like on issues of Israel, if we're thinking about, you know, trying to advance Western goals or American goals here?
Well, the universities have related differently to different American interests, but the American recognition of Israel was a major turning point in the American relationship, the relationship of the U.S. government to these universities, and also the way that these universities have related to American foreign policy interests. As your listeners likely know, in the debate in the 40s about whether or not to whether or not the U.S. should recognize Israel, the American foreign policy and political establishment was very much divided on this question. Very respected leaders, including George Marshall, for example, opposed the American recognition of Israel. And I talk in the book that the leaders of American universities in the region, almost without exception, opposed American recognition of Israel because they feared that if the U.S. ended up recognizing Israel, this would complicate their standing and security in the region. Now, in that respect, they were correct that after the U.S. recognized the state of Israel, the climate at these universities became much more controversial, delicate, and contentious vis-a-vis the people of the region. And I document in the book that the American support for Israel has been a source of contention with these universities. And I think that because the American people and American foreign policy elite now is so overwhelmingly in support of Israel, and the U.S.-Israel alliance, that I think is one of the reasons why the universities have played a little bit less of a role today in American foreign policy than they did prior to 1948.
Mm-hmm. Well, and what is the source of funding for these universities? I mean, you, of course, when you talk about the foundings of in Iraq and Afghanistan, those are basically government-backed universities. But for AUB and AUC, where do they get their funding? I mean, you mentioned in the book that, you know, government funding from the United States is also a significant source and sort of fluctuates up and down. So what is the financial aspect layout of these schools like?
Well, today, I mean, there's some support, American government support at the American University of Beirut and Cairo, but it's actually not much. And I mean, one of the and insofar as there is American support at these universities, a lot of it is steered toward providing student scholarships, which actually is something that I criticize in the book. I argue that there may be better ways the American government can invest in these universities. But the sources of funding are fairly diverse. Both of these universities have educated a number of the region's elites. A number of industries in the region see value in investing in the universities. Regional governments have provided support. So it comes from a lot of different sources, but today at the American University of Beirut and Cairo, American government support is a relatively small percentage of the funding.
Mm-hmm. And have these universities ever faced any sort of backlash from the United States, say, with cuts in funding precisely because of, say, you know, opposition over policies or, you know, any sort of support for Hezbollah or opposition to Israel?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, if you look at the amount of American support that was going, for example, to the American University of Beirut, it has been cut quite a bit from highs sort of in the 20th century. And a big part of that is precisely because of the factors that you mentioned, the rise of radicalism at these universities, the lack of stability, perceptions that they don't support American interests sufficiently, hostility to Israel and the like. So this has been a very difficult balancing act for American academic leaders at these universities, that how do you, on the one hand, make sure that you're in touch with the people in these countries and their political and social sensibilities, while also being able to appeal to the American government, American policymakers, and the like.
Mm-hmm. Well, are there any other similar experiences of such universities around the world that you know of American universities? Has there been any similar drive to found American universities in, like, say, Asia? Is there any sort of other region we could compare and contrast to?
Yes, there are American universities around the world. And there's a very good book by a scholar named Kyle Long, L-O-N-G, who also, in fact, used to teach at the American University in Iraq. And he has done a book-length study basically looking at this phenomenon of American universities around the world. There's an American university in Paris. There are American universities all over. And, you know, I think this is something that I think it's not sufficiently appreciated in American foreign policy discussions. But if you look at one of the most meaningful, significant, widespread, and ultimately popular sources of American influence in the world, it's really our higher education system. And it's quite interesting because if you look at our domestic debates in American politics, especially in today's climate, American universities are just right at the center of all kinds of controversies over free speech, political correctness, et cetera. I mean, I would even say there's sort of a full-on culture war in America today over the influence of American universities and liberal arts education. Whereas I would say that when you look around the world, even in countries and regions where there's very high degrees of anti-Americanism, very powerful currents of opposition to American foreign policy, there is a seemingly insatiable demand for an American higher education. And for those who cannot, for whatever reason, come to the U.S. To actually experience an American education here in the U.S., these American universities abroad provide a source of interest. And by the way, I'll just add to that. I mean, one of the things that I found traveling in the region, especially in the Gulf, which I found very interesting, is that although the reason, of course, why these Gulf countries are investing in American universities is to help their own people and their own country's development, these universities are becoming very popular for students, for example, in Asia. Like I met students coming from South Asia, East Asia, and the like, who were coming to Qatar for their undergraduate studies just to experience an American education.
Mm-hmm. I guess the example I would think of is Asia. I would compare and contrast. I'm not too aware of too many American universities in Asia. I guess the idea that occurs to me is that, you know, Asia, Japan in particular, is sort of known for, they really, East Asia, they really embraced Westernization, and they, you know, they founded their own universities. The only thing I can sort of think of is being a graduate of Amherst College, we had the first Japanese graduate of an American institution of higher education on 1872, I think it was. And this individual went back to Japan and later helped found Doshisha University in Japan, which is sort of modeled, thinking of, you know, like American education is supposed to be sort of like modeled on American universities. That was one sort of parallel that came to mind. You know, it strikes me that maybe there's a developmental difference that, you know, East Asia has really embraced these ideas that we think of in the West, including education, and has developed their own universities, whereas, again, the Middle East is still lagging behind.
Well, you know, one of the things that's a little bit counterintuitive, but it's interesting, I mentioned that Qatar and the UAE are regional outliers in terms of their embrace of American universities. I would actually say that these two countries are global outliers. And I would also say that actually the Middle East, in many ways, among other regions, is also an outlier in the extent to which it has really tried hard to recruit American universities. And it's very interesting because we don't think about the Middle East as being a source, a region that's particularly distinguished by higher educational achievement. And that's true. But in a sense, precisely because kind of modern higher education has lagged in the region so much relative to other regions, paradoxically, you know, in a sense, it's an advantage because once a government in the region decides that they want to emphasize higher education, they kind of have the luxury, in a sense, of starting from scratch and figuring out what they want. So, you know, you compare, for example, let's say a country like India, for lead educational leaders or political leaders in India to start make a decision that they want to have American style higher education, you know, now they have to compete with all kinds of constituencies at existing Indian universities that are, that have their own constituencies and the like. Also, because many countries in Asia are democracies, they're a little bit more responsive to their own people. Whereas, you know, when a monarchy in the Middle East with a bunch of money and limited democratic accountability decides that they're going to get into the modern higher education game, they sort of have the luxury of pushing forward with these initiatives very quickly, very suddenly, with a lot of money and limited opposition from home.
Well, one thing, I guess, you know, thinking of this individual, I'm trying to remember his name offhand, who helped found Doshishu University in Japan. You know, in your book, you talk about, for example, Laura Bush, the first lady within the George W. Bush administration. She took a real big interest in the university in Afghanistan, really interested in like women's rights. Discuss that a bit. Who are some of the key individuals behind these universities and what sort of roles have they played, like Laura Bush?
Well, Laura Bush is an interesting example. So if you recall, I mean, after 9/11, obviously the impetus for American intervention in Afghanistan was counterterrorism, first and foremost. But after the initial intervention, the mission expanded into state building, nation building. But there was always an emphasis right from the beginning that the U.S. was going to go in and liberate Afghan women and that women's rights be a priority in Afghanistan. Now, Laura Bush really kind of took that on as a cause, the cause of women's rights in Afghanistan generally, and she really decided to emphasize the American University of Afghanistan. I would say that that probably was the single biggest cause that she adopted as a first lady, certainly on the foreign policy front anyway. And one of the reasons, I think, why support for this university continued, and it received actually pretty extraordinary amounts of American support from USAID and so forth relative to other comparable initiatives. One of the reasons was because even after the Bush administration left office, Hillary Clinton and Michelle Obama and others invested in the university as a means of promoting women's rights. I think in that sense, there are legitimate questions that I think have to be asked here, that the US poured enormous amounts, not only of money, but also political capital and the like, into this university as a means of promoting women's rights. And now that the university has been overrun, there are very serious questions that I think policymakers have to ask about whether or not it was worth doing.
Yeah, I guess looking at the issue of women's rights in general, if we look at AUB or AUC or you know, these two foundings in Iraq and Afghanistan during this global war on terror period, and now the branches of the American universities in Qatar, how has that issue in particular fared at these universities? I mean, what sort of success have these universities have had in promoting such agendas, which are indeed often touted with respect to the Muslim world, that's something we all really need to advance?
Well, I think as you've written in your own writing, it's very interesting that the trend line in terms of women's rights in the Middle East has changed quite a bit. So in many ways, I mean, the women were in some ways in the 1920s in the Middle East, for example, dealing with a context in which Islamist restrictions and the like were less than what came later in the 70s and 80s and so forth. So, I mean, these universities have always tried to integrate women into these universities. And I think it's fair to say that these universities, generally speaking, have been a source of providing education and rights and the like for women. At the same time, I think that one could argue that when you look at the backlash in the region to women's rights, especially from Islamist groups and the like, one source, maybe a minor source, but a source nevertheless of why there's been this Islamist backlash has been due to the influence of these universities. They're seen as kind of challenging traditional modes of authority and the like in the region. But it's very interesting that in Qatar, for example, which is ostensibly a Wahhabist, Islamist country, women very much dominate the higher education scene generally, and even the American higher education scene there. I mean, in fact, one of the greatest challenges for the government of Qatar is to figure out how do you convince Qatari men to even want to go to these universities and to take seriously the preparation and rigor required to do well at these places.
Mm-hmm. I guess in thinking of women's rights, you know, that brings up issues to my mind, at least of Tunisia. I guess it occurs to me that, you know, sort of one country that had maybe post-Arab Spring, maybe some success trying to install in a democratic government. I mean, now they're going through this upheaval where, you know, the president has stepped in and thrown out the old government, and they're having a new constitution, which, for example, they're going to remove any reference to Islam, apparently. How does the, thinking of education, how does the, Tunisia was a long time a colony of France. How does the French higher education system compare in its relationship to Tunisia with these other American university systems we're speaking of?
I don't know a lot about the French experience in Tunisia specifically, but I do look in the book at the French experience, one in Lebanon, as we discussed. The other interesting French case study is in Abu Dhabi. So when the UAE was thinking about inviting branch campuses, it made actually a pretty significant, it put quite a bit of money into trying to see if a French university could come there and survive and do well. And I would say that the French branch campus experience in the UAE has fallen far short of what the aspirations were. And I think the reason's fairly simple, which is that they've just had a hard time recruiting students who want to do their educations in French language. I think people in the region correctly recognize that if you're going to embark on getting a foreign degree, a college degree or a graduate degree, you may as well do it in the English language, and you may as well get the benefit of a American or British education, which provides with it many more employment and other opportunities.
Yeah, indeed. You note that in the book. I mean, indeed, English is becoming in so many ways, you know, the lingua franca, the dominant language of the world. I mean, particularly with respect to English. I mean, if you're with respect to academia, if you're going to be involved in academia, I guess sooner or later you will want to go to the United States or to Britain. So that's really the language you're looking at. So, French is I guess really losing out. I think I recall reading somewhere that even in Tunisia, that's sort of an issue that people want to learn more English now. You also talk a lot about these universities, the role they have, the relationship they have with the American government, that, for example, a lot of diplomats and government personnel will go there to get, say, Arabic training. Is that still predominant today, or has that suffered a decline? Or discuss that, the history of that relationship.
Yeah, that's very interesting. You would think that this is a relatively benign sort of situation, that Americans would go to these universities, get training in language, and that there would be nothing controversial about that. In fact, I mean, this has been a highly contentious, highly controversial aspect of these universities. And the reason is because when you look at American diplomats, American military personnel, American academicians, It makes perfect sense why they would want to go to the American University of Beirut, let's say, to learn a little bit about the region, learn the language and so forth. Now, the trouble is that when they go there, it's not just language skills that they acquire. They also sort of develop friendships there. They become integrated with the societies. They develop, they really become socialized in the region. And one very common criticism of American diplomats and others who study in the region is that they end up absorbing the political influences and the politics of the country. And so a very common and longstanding critique, for example, from pro-Israel policymakers against the so-called Arabists is that as a consequence of their education at AUB, they end up adopting overtly hostile views to Israel or positions in the Arab-Israeli conflict that lean too much on the Arab side. And so often you've seen presidential administrations come into power in America that are very supportive of Israel, who look with suspicion, sometimes I would say even contempt, at the at these diplomats and others who have an affiliation with these universities because they suspect them, sometimes correctly, of not sharing their intuitions on foreign policy questions.
Yeah, that's something that's often been discussed. I've read about, I guess the British expression "going native" comes to mind. You know, that you go into another culture and sort of immerse yourself in that culture, and then you depending on the individual, you can indeed lose your perspective to say, hey, look, you know, you're representing your country. You're supposed to represent that country, and you're supposed to thereby have a critical outlook on critically analyze how your country interacts with other countries. Why another perspective might be wrong, or not to just simply accept whatever someone at, say, in Beirut at AUB says. I guess that raises then, I guess, a dilemma that, where else would anyone in the government, say, to work in the Foreign Service, where else would they learn at, say, Arabic, or learn about the culture? I mean, well, of course, you have the language schools of the government, of the Foreign Service and so forth. But I guess, many would say that, a key advantage is simply going there. So that creates kind of a dilemma.
Yeah, and I talk about this in the case study of the American University in Cairo in particular. And I focus, for example, on the revolution against Hosni Mubarak. And the American community affiliated with AUC was kind of on all sides of this conflict. So you look, for example, at people serving on the board, many of these are former State Department officials and the like. They were among the most sympathetic people in many ways to the Mubarak government because they had, just having spent time in Egypt, having, in one case served, or many, a few different cases actually served as U.S. ambassador to Egypt. They had really gotten to know officials in the Egyptian government. They had formed a relationship with them, and they didn't especially look favorably at the idea that their friends in power would be overthrown. At the same time, many of the American students and even faculty members at the university had developed friendships with the democratic activists, the student leaders on campus. And so they looked favorably, maybe overly optimistic, at the idea that they might really be able to orchestrate a democratic revolution in the country. And so the way that Americans go to these universities and the insights that they develop about the region can vary quite a bit.
Well, I guess just one closing thought, given your studies, what would you recommend? What should American policies think about, policymakers think about their relationship with American higher education institutions and how it can serve American goals?
Well, I think one dilemma is to figure out what are American goals. I mean, I think that we're speaking right now at a time where I think just very core fundamental questions in American foreign policy are up for grabs. I mean, I think in contrast to a few years ago, even I don't see much will to do American-led nation building and state building. So obviously, if you're not doing state and nation building, you're not going to be necessarily building the universities like in Afghanistan and Iraq. I think the main lesson I would simply say to policymakers, though, is to recognize that the promotion of American universities in the region is one of the most consistent, longstanding tendencies in American foreign policy. And it's one of the initiatives that even during periods when America has really been under attack in the region, the people in the region and the governments in the region really want and welcome. And I think the question to think about is, how do we take advantage of the desire for American education and leverage that on behalf of American interests?
Well, for our listeners out there, you've been listening to another episode of Conservative Casual Friday with your show host, Andrew Herod, where we like to discuss important issues of the day for conservatives and others, and also possibly for any viewers who will also be watching us on television. And we've been discussing with Pratik Chugale, experienced Washington, D.C. writer and government, also government service veteran. And he's been discussing his book here, American Universities in the Middle East and U.S. Foreign Policy, Intersections with American Interest. Very interesting book. I highly recommend you get it. Well, Pratik, thank you for joining the show.
Thank you for having me.
All right. And for our listeners and viewers out there, join us next Friday for another episode of Conservative Casual Friday.